Mrs. Eddy by Hugh Studdard Kennedy. Chapter 40. Defections and Loyalties. She needed all Calvin's faithfulness. Although the number of those attaching themselves to her company and remaining faithful increased year by year, those who fell away were still very many, and were often from among those who had been nearest to her. Mrs. Eddy seems to have recognized, almost from the first, that in the end, her work would have to be done alone. But she parted reluctantly from the sense of personal joys, as she sternly characterized the small bonds of human affection with which she sought to fill a void in her life. In the end, she realized, and with tremendous abundance, that the seeming vacuum is already filled with divine love. But when she lavished her affection on Richard Kennedy, or Daniel Spofford, or Miranda Rice, or begged her son George to come to her when she was widowed and homeless, or adopted as a son one whom she thought would be a strong arm in her support and in support of the cause she had made her own, she was casting round for human help and encouragement. For a short time in the summer of 1892, just after she moved into Pleasant View, her son George had come east to visit her. He left his wife behind, but brought with him his little son, George III. Mrs. Eddy was delighted. She took a great fancy to the little boy. But George came and went as he had done in the past. And when he had gone, it seemed to her a greater comfort than ever before that she had by her one, like her adopted son, Benny, who seemed to understand so well what she wanted to do and was so ready to help her. Foster Eddy was now president of the Mother Church and manager of the publishing house. He spent most of his time in Boston, but came out to Concord frequently, and Benny's room at Pleasant View was always kept ready for his reception. But Ebenezer J. Foster Eddy was to prove a sore disappointment. Disturbing stories began to reach Pleasant View about his personal conduct, not the least of which was the rumor that he was guilty of improprieties with a married woman in his office. Journal subscriptions were lagging, even if book royalties were increasing. Suspicion and dissension grew, until an open break could not well be averted. It did not take long for Mrs. Eddy to make up her mind that her protege was being victimized by animal magnetism, and that she, as the leader of the movement, was the ultimate object of evil's onslaught. No sooner had this become her clear conviction than she took action. Action at once. Bold, stern, and final. The fate of the cause, her very life's blood, seemed again in jeopardy, and one cannot recount what followed without painting the vivid picture of a seasoned general at war. The quiet reconnoitering, the mobilizing of forces, the ebb and flow of morale, the excitement of open conflict, the flicker of mutiny, the call to allegiance, the rallying to the standard. It may be supposed that Mrs. Eddy endeavored earnestly to bring her adopted son around to her way of thinking. It is certain that recrimination fell with increasing frequency until at last there was left nothing but drastic measures to be taken. Already his mentor had written him, under date of March 17, 1897, that his work was unsatisfactory, that his attitude and conduct reprehensible, his protests and reassurances valueless. I was not falsely referring to your mind on me. I am not and cannot be mistaken now in whose mind is on me, she wrote. But you were governed by hypnotism to work against me and yourself. This fruitless controversy, which boded so much evil to the great cause, as its leaders saw the matter, could be, must be, terminated. Seizing upon the occasion of the first members' meeting currently in session, she dispatched a special letter directing the adoption of this startling bylaw. A member of this church, who is a student of Reverend Mary Baker Eddy, and refuses to leave a place in the field that she knows it is for his or her interest to leave, and so advise him or her, yet they do not comply with my request, this member shall be dropped from the roll of membership, and he or she treated by this church as a disloyal student. This bylaw can only be amended or annulled by the unanimous vote of every member of this church. The immediate enactment of this statute was imperative if the movement was to survive. The accompanying letter explained, "For I cannot be your leader unless I have the power to guide you when you need this guidance." Foster Eddy, who was uncomfortably enough in the chair, must have put up a convincing defense, for the members wavered. In fact, they found it necessary to repair to Concord and confer with Mrs. Eddy herself before taking a vote. Needless to say, the tide had turned, for to be in disfavor with Mrs. Eddy was to be in disrepute with the membership. Dr. Ebenezer J. Foster Eddy was unceremoniously stripped of his offices and his titles, and swiftly relegated to the ranks. The remaining story is a long and involved one, but it may be briefly summarized in the observation that he drifted into obscurity, not to be heard of again until his reappearance 10 years later in the next friend's suit, to be described in due order. The whole proceeding may not be above criticism, but it needs to be remembered that the movement was in a state of war, and that Mrs. Eddy had no alternative but to deal ruthlessly with what she saw as treachery. As to the justice of her appraisals and verdicts, of those who insist upon interpreting the record, opinion must be divided. not a few believe that Mrs. Eddy's judgment was infallible because of her ordination from above to lead humanity out of the wilderness. Others feel that many who fell before her onward march were the victims of court intrigue. Certain it is that few survived, whatever their faults or virtues, and that all had to defend themselves against household gossip as the sainted leader grew steadily more secluded with her work and her immediate associates. Available correspondence with the abjectly devoted Dr. Julia Field King and a wealth of other documentary evidence show this over and over again. Even the impeccable Edward Kimball, writing to Judge Septimus Hanna as late as November 29, 1907, lamented that there were those prominent enough to command the leader's ear who were beating a constant pathway to her door to carry the evil insinuation that his teaching was wrong in order to discredit him in her eyes and thus dispose of an interloper. How could anyone, however great, be wholly unmoved by the constant stream of provocative reports, unrelieved by any counteracting statements? That Mrs. Eddy did as well as she did is surely to her everlasting credit. As has been before noted, it was from the first characteristic of the movement that for every one who dropped out, there was always one, and sometimes many, to take his place. In 1895 and the years which followed, this was increasingly true. When the church was dedicated, Mrs. Eddy already had around her, or within immediate call, a group of people whose names were later to become well known in the movement. And the great majority of them were to remain faithful right through to the end. Of these, among the most notable, were Judge Septimus J. Hanna, William B. Johnson, Edward A. Kimball, James A. Neal, and William P. McKenzie. Judge Septimus Hanna was perhaps the most prominent in the period under consideration. He had become interested in Christian Science in 1886, while practicing as a lawyer in Leadville, Colorado, famous for its altitude above sea level, 10,200 feet, and for its mines of gold and silver. His wife, Camilla, had been healed of a serious physical trouble, and they both took up the study of Christian Science with much earnestness, corresponding with Mrs. Eddy in regard to receiving instructions from her and making plans for devoting themselves exclusively to the work. In 1890, they moved to Scranton, Pennsylvania, where Judge Hanna, he had served for a time as county judge in Council Bluffs, Iowa, hence the title, was elected Speaker of the Church there. About this time, he began to contribute articles to the journal, which attracted much attention. And in the summer of 1891, he was invited to deliver the sermon for the original Church of Christ Scientist in Boston. Next year, he was appointed editor of the journal, and his wife, assistant editor, positions they continued to occupy for more than 10 years. Of the others, William B. Johnson, already mentioned as accompanying Mrs. Eddy on her memorable journey to Chicago in 1888, had become interested in 1882 through a healing of rupture and chronic ill health, the result of hardships suffered during 3 years' service in the Civil War. He later became a director of the Mother Church and appears and reappears in the story. Edward A. Kimball, destined afterwards to become the first great apostle of the movement, was from Chicago. James A. Neal, later a director, was from Boston. And William P. McKenzie, also a director, was from Almonte, Canada. These three, however, do not appear very prominently on the scene until several years later. They are mentioned here because they are among the most notable of those who, amidst much defection, maintained their loyalty to the end. It was about this time, too, when the wonder aroused over the spread and scope of the movement, as revealed in the dedication of the church in Boston, had somewhat subsided, that Christian Science began to be accepted as an important new theology, and to be considered as something that would have to be reckoned with in any future record of religious history. The voice of ridicule was by no means silenced. Mark Twain's onslaught was still 10 years away. But now, wherever the movement established itself, although it made enemies aplenty, it also made friends among those who were far from subscribing to the demands of its teaching. With the press, the activities of the movement, especially when related to Mrs. Eddy, became news to an increasing extent, not from the point of view of ridicule, as had so often been the case in the past, but for fundamental reasons. In Boston, from now on, Christian Science, with its church and publishing house and all their activities, is taken for granted, while it is possible to detect in the tone of the press a certain civic pride in the fact that the city was the headquarters of a worldwide movement, for so it was now rapidly becoming. But the larger it grew, and the more eager its adherents, the more surely did Mrs. Eddy withdraw from any public contact with it. It was, as had been noted, fully 3 months after the completion of the church that she first saw it, and another 2 months were to pass by before she occupied its pulpit for the first time. When she did, it was Sunday, May 26, 1895. The fact that she was to be present at the morning service was known only to a very few. The fact that she was to speak only to herself. Her presence was unknown, says the journal's account of the matter, until her appearance in the aisle of the auditorium on her way to the pulpit. The services had proceeded as usual until they were more than half concluded when she stepped upon the platform. After listening to the organ and a solo, she stepped to the desk and, without text or note, addressed the congregation for upwards of 20 minutes. Her glowing words of kindly greeting, love, admonition, and warning were intently and eagerly listened to by all. At the close of the benediction, the audience were requested to remain seated until Mrs. Eddy passed out, as it would have been impracticable to have personally met all the large audience. The journal adds that the event was a memorable one, and expressed the hope that there would be many repetitions of it. But there was to be only one more such appearance. One Sunday in the following February, Mrs. Eddy preached again in the Mother Church, coming unexpectedly, as she had done the first time, and returning immediately afterwards to Concord. After that, although in the remaining 15 years of her life she made several public appearances of a similar nature, she never preached again in the Mother Church. Immediately following the account of the first sermon, the journal prints a letter written by a boy to his mother after he had attended the service and heard Mrs. Eddy speak. It is an interesting letter, as affording a glimpse of Mrs. Eddy at this time and of the impression she made on those who saw and heard her. The letter runs, "Dear Mother, I have just returned from church, where I had the pleasure of seeing and hearing Mrs. Eddy. I think only a few of the congregation knew any more than I did that she was going to be there. I do not know now why she came this particular day. Anyway, when the lesson was half through to verse 27, the reader stopped, and she came into the auditorium and passed up on to the platform. The audience rose to their feet when they saw her coming in. She did not stop in the center or step to the most prominent point behind the desk, but simply to one side, and after bowing a welcome to the audience, she sat down and rested her head in silent prayer. Then a lady in the choir sang a beautiful solo, after which Mrs. Eddy arose and, stepping to the desk, spoke in a quiet, pleasant voice, very distinct, for you could easily hear every word. And yet she seemed to be talking as if she were in a small room sitting only a few feet from you, instead of in that large church. Mrs. Eddy did not preach. She took no text. But I wish I could write you all she said. She must have spoken for 20 minutes. She said it all in such a simple, loving way. I don't wonder that she is loved. She is all love. You simply feel as if she was your best friend. For several Sundays after this, The church was thronged in the hope that Mrs. Eddy would speak again. So much so that in the journal for August, she published a statement to the effect that, in the future, she would notify the church directors when she would be present, emphasizing once again that the only pastor of the church was the Bible and science and health. Therefore, beloved, she added, my often coming is unnecessary. For though I be present or absent, it is God that feedeth the hungry heart, that giveth grace for grace, that healeth the sick and cleanseth the sinner. The journal carried her message, if not round the world, certainly all over the United States and Canada, for the movement was growing now prodigiously. An examination of an issue of the journal about this time shows that it was devoting no less than 43 pages to announcements of church services and practitioners in the United States and Canada. While, as its records show, the new teaching had already gained a foothold at the other side of the Atlantic.